This is Medical Spa MD. Hello there and welcome to the show where we give you the inside information and the word from the experts to help physicians take control of their medical practices and lifestyle. Even if you're clueless about running a business and you're already working 60-hour weeks, Medical Spa MD is brought to you by medicalspamd.com, a worldwide community of physicians practicing cosmetic medicine. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Andy. How are you doing today?
I'm very, very well. This is episode 4, isn't it?
It is. It is episode 4.
So what's been happening, Jeff, in the medical world? I saw an interesting post here on Allergan. What's the story with Allergan? $600 million poorer.
Oh, yes. Well, Allergan kind of got their hand caught in the cookie jar, and the federal government decided to slam the lid down a little bit. Evidently, according to the FDA, Allergan had been paying doctors millions of dollars and teaching them how to miscode the drug Botox to be able to use it for off-label treatments for which it had never been approved.
And now, miscoding, Jeff, is this basically how it's classified?
No, what they were probably doing, and I've only seen the news report, so I don't know exactly what happened inside of the courtroom or whatever happened between the lawyers, but they were probably teaching physicians how to code for something other than what they were using the treatment for. Now, in the U.S., when you have a third-party payment system, the physician will code the treatment that he is performing. There's a code for literally every treatment. And so there are things that Botox is approved for, migraine headaches and other kinds of things. But if you are treating somebody for wrinkles around their eyes and you are coding that as though you're treating them for migraine headaches, that's, in effect, miscoding that treatment.
Okay. So it's more to do with the way that the drug is being used, is it?
Yes. Now, off-label usage is legal. A physician, once a drug has been FDA approved, can treat with anything that they actually think the drug might be effective for. An MD or a DO has very, very kind of wide latitude as to how they kind of go about that and how they decide what something is going to be treated for. However, they kind of came down, and that was the judgment, or Botox ended up having to pay $600 million. Now, they are somewhat closer to a number of potential approvals for other uses, but that is a $600 million little slap on the wrist that Botox or Allergan got from the FDA, for sure. That's going to hurt.
Yeah. Yes, I imagine it will hurt. Well, moving on, a bit later in the show, we've got you interviewed Adrian Richards, didn't you? We'll talk about Adrian in a minute. But I've got a question for you. How much do you use social media and things like Facebook?
Well, we are actually using it a lot. And in fact, the community, Medical Spy MD, is now extended, and we're integrating with a number of other things. We have groups on LinkedIn, and we have both, Medical Spy MD has a fan page.
Okay.
On Facebook, but we are also starting a number of groups on Facebook in order to teach or to, involve physicians who are interested in a very kind of specific learning inside of the medium that we're teaching. So, for example, we have a group on Facebook that is called Physicians and Facebook Marketing, How to Do It Correctly. And so our staff, as well as other physicians who are, marketing on Facebook, belong to this group and help teach physicians how to do Facebook marketing on Facebook. Now, it's very common that physicians now, or medical spas or whatever, will have a fan page or some other kind of thing, because they realize that their patients, there's now 500 million members on Facebook, all of their patients are on Facebook, and it would be very appropriate and a great marketing tool to be able to get in front of them. But they do it poorly, very, very poorly. So you'll often see a medical spa that might have had 10,000 members or 10,000 patients come through its doors in the last 5 or 6 years, and they've got, you know, 50 friends on Facebook, which is literally, I mean, it's just pathetic. And the reason is that they're, you know, not building a community. They're not providing any value. They put up links that are endlessly, you know, come in Friday and we'll give you, you know, free bananas, whatever, you know, I don't know what they're doing, but it's just piss poor. And so, we got a lot of inquiries around this kind of stuff, where often when speaking with physicians, they'll also kind of talk about this just a little bit, like, what should I be doing on Facebook, or is Twitter any good for me, or that kind of a thing. And so we decided to start a number of groups. This is the first one, Physicians and Facebook Marketing, on Facebook, in order to kind of teach them how to do that. So if you're interested at all, it's not necessarily physicians only. We are going to be teaching how to market on Facebook and how to grow your business that way. But our focus, of course, is for physicians.
I know this is very early days, Jeff, but what sort of, how do you think it's going so far?
It's going really, really well. I know that I've got a couple of people that are going to be literally teaching inside of this group that I respect a great deal. I'm going to be actually in there. We've been very successful in you know, with growing a number of businesses through Facebook. And so we're going to share that information with our community. And really the nice thing about it is that it extends the community past only medicalspamd.com, which will probably always be the main portion. But you can literally go to Facebook and sign up and become a member of the community and stay on Facebook and derive at least some of the value that all Medical Spa MD members get. So like the sign-up form is now on Facebook. We actually sign physicians up who find us through Facebook and have never even seen the site. So those are the types of things that we're also going to be teaching how to do for physicians wherever they are.
Interesting stuff. Right, let's move on to that interview with Adrian Richards. Now, I actually have known Adrian for about a year now, and he's a very interesting guy. I suppose he's a lot like the people you interview over here, but the English version, Jeff, because he's very much into the social media side of things.
That's very true, and there are some very striking differences between medicine in the U.S. and medicine in the U.K. or the European Union, and we talk about those quite a bit. Mm. One of the things that I thought was very, very interesting and had never really known this was that a title for a surgeon in the U.K. is Mr.
Uh-huh. What do you call him in the U.S. then?
Well, we call him Doctor.
Okay.
And, you know, there's just some very kind of striking differences that I think pretty much everybody would find very interesting in this interview. And he's a great guy. He's really embraced social media. As you know, he's got like 5 different podcasts that he does. He runs, I don't know how big that clinic is, but they've got 4 or 5 locations. And I think it looked like eight physicians, cosmetic surgeons and dermatologists working at these locations. So it's a rather big practice, and very interesting to understand how he goes about harnessing his marketing efforts, which he's involved in because he likes it a great deal, and how he's kind of started that and what the results have been for him, which have, you know, been really good.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to that interview now, Jeff, with you speaking to Adrian Richards, who is a cosmetic and aesthetic surgeon.
First thing, Jeff, is that in the UK, I don't know if your listeners know that surgeons are actually called Mr. rather than Doctor, which is different. Yeah, different from the States, isn't it?
And how did that kind of come about? Because I did notice that on your site, you have, it looked like maybe 8 physicians, and they were all a mister except for one who was a doctor as a prefix.
Well, basically, over here, you either sort of decide after you qualify as a doctor whether you want to go down a surgical route, you call it, don't you, or a medical route. And if you go follow a medical route, you know, you may be a chest physician or something, yet you'll stay as a doctor. If you go down the surgical route and you take the surgical exam, which is called the Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, when you get that, you actually revert back to a mister, or if you're a lady, a miss. And the reason for that is that in the early days, you know, 400 or 500 years ago, surgeons who, you know, sort of amputated limbs weren't medically trained. They often were sort of barbers, like, you know, Sweeney Todd the barber. they were sort of doing those procedures. So it's just sort of traditional. You know how we are in England. We're sort of just very traditional, and that's the way it's remained.
And so your patients refer to you as Mr. Richards?
Yeah. So I was a doctor. So I qualified. I was a doctor for, you know, 6-7 years. Then I got my surgical exams, and then you revert back to Mr.
That's striking to me, because in the US, physicians are really trained in medical school to kind of take control of a situation and, in effect, set themselves slightly apart as an authority figure.
Well, in the UK, in England, people know that your surgeon would be Mr. They would be worried if they were operated on by a doctor. They just know, you know, Mr. Stanley is doing my varicose veins. They expect it to be a Mr. They associate the word Mr. with a surgeon. It's a very different training. Basically, we start medical school at the age of 18 normally. We start earlier. So we don't go to college. So there isn't really a college system. We would go straight into university at 18. We spend 5 years at medical school. And then after that, sort of the age of sort of 23, that we qualify as doctors, which I think is earlier than in America. Then we do some sort of basic training, you know, to really sort of find out what we wanted to do before you decide on your speciality. But our training would be longer. So, for instance, I qualified in 1988, but I didn't become a consultant till 2001, which is 13 years. So it's 13 years after becoming a doctor until I become a fully qualified plastic surgeon. So although we start longer, our actual training to become a plastic surgeon is longer.
And so are there fewer plastic surgeons in the UK than there are per capita in the US? Do you know?
Oh, yeah, way, way lower. I mean, there were only, until about 10 years ago, there were only 200, so for 60 million people. So, I mean, that's had all sorts of implications on the industry over here. And one of the main differences in America, in the US, is there's always been quite a few very well-trained plastic surgeons. So each city would have a lot of plastic surgeons. You know, my father lives in Philadelphia. You know, I know there's more, way more plastic surgeons per capita than there are in the UK.
So you've got universal coverage, which we're just moving to in the United States. And so the fact that you're in retail cosmetic medicine or elective medicine, how does that kind of fit in with, you know, the general practice of medicine in the UK?
Well, basically, we have a system called the NHS, which is the National Health System, which was really set up after the war, after the Second World War. Because after the Second World War, you know, the standard of health care wasn't very good in England. So they set up so it's called the NHS. So basically, if you're ill, you're having a child, you know, it's all covered. No one has to pay anything. You just go along, any sort of injury, whatever, you get paid. Now, there are things around the edges which is a bit blurred. So, you know, prominent ear correction, breast reconstruction after cancer, varicose veins, hernias, carpal tunnel syndrome. Those sort of things have traditionally been covered. Even, you know, when I was training, breast reductions, breast enlargements, those sort of procedures were performed on the health system. But they're tightening up a lot because it's, you know, it's costing more money. The system, you know, is very expensive to run. So they're tightening up a lot on the sort of procedures which aren't medically necessary.
And so your practice is predominantly cosmetic surgery, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yeah, what happened, I mean, so, you know, in 2001, when I qualified as a plastic surgeon, what happens is you're taken on by a hospital as a consultant plastic surgeon. And then in those days, I was taken on by Stoke Mandeville, which is one of the main regional plastic surgical centers, which had a big burn center, a big spinal injury center. So I used to do a lot of hand surgery, a lot of breast surgery, a lot of burn surgery, an awful lot of that sort of thing. And I also worked sort of 1.5 days as a private surgeon externally to that. And I just found I was getting too busy on the other side. So I sort of, after 5 years, left the health system to work in my own clinic, which is what I do now.
And so that's entirely elective plastic surgery. And with very few plastic surgeons, what's the demand like?
Well, I've got too much work, to be honest. So I have been working for the last 2 days, 12-hour operation. So I operate for 12 hours on Monday, 12 hours on Tuesday. And I think the other thing is that English surgeons tend to be a lot quicker than surgeons in the US. When I went to the US, you know, I did notice the surgeons, the procedure seemed to take longer. So on a typical operating day, I would maybe do 2 facelifts, you know, 2 or 3 breast enlargements and a breast reduction each day. That would be my normal day, and I would do that twice a week, you know, on Monday and Tuesday, and again a half day on Thursday. So every week I would be operating on, you know, 10 significant size cases. And I've sort of reached my limit of what I can physically do. So then what we've done in Aurora Clinics, which is the clinical side to our business, is we've taken on other surgeons. So we've got a rhinoplasty surgeon, an oculoplastic surgeon who deals with eyelids, a liposuction surgeon. You know, so we've got all – so what we're doing is incorporating other surgeons with other subspecialties.
What is a typical waiting time in order to get into to your clinic as a patient?
Well, you can get a clinic appointment pretty quick, normally within a couple of weeks. To see me, you can normally see me, but I'm pretty much fully booked for 3 months. The danger, you know, Jeff, is that people ask you for operations, you say yes, and then you find your list is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you tend to be, you know, chasing your tail a bit. So I'm trying to be strict and limit the time I operate now.
Would you say that the demand is outstripping the medical community's ability to meet that?
No, I tell you what it is, Jeff. So I was at a conference last week of the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, and I was talking to a lot of my peers, and essentially what they were saying is they are quieter. So I know a lot of American surgeons are quieter since the the crash, you know, the economic problems, and it's the same in England. So the amount of work, I think, is down. However, I think because of our efforts in the sort of social media of communicating real information, we are getting busier. So although the pie might be smaller, our bit of the pie is getting bigger.
Looking through your sites, it's obvious that you have really embraced social media and online marketing as part of your marketing mix. 2 questions. How much of your marketing advertising budget or time is actually spent now online as opposed to more traditional kind of marketing methods? And how effective is that?
Nearly all of it is online. I think it's slightly different in America, because in America, you know, if you work in Pittsburgh or somewhere, you know, everyone's going to come from Pittsburgh, really. Well, I mean, they may travel over the states, I don't know, but you are more big city with like a hub with spokes going in. And that was the same as when I was in Australia. It was a similar sort of pattern. So I don't know whether a surgeon in Pittsburgh needs to be high. It needs to be very prominent on the internet in California. Would they, Jeff?
No, they wouldn't. No. But they would want to. You know, the truth of that is that the competition in the United States sounds as though It's much more competitive in that there are a tremendous number of both plastic surgeons and dermatologists and now aesthetic physicians in one sort or another that are using technology as opposed to surgical procedures. But generally, your population draw is going to be, you know, a maximum of maybe 100 or 200 miles away, which, of course, is England almost, you know.
Yeah, well, that's right. So essentially, I think the pattern's a bit different. You see, I mean, you know, if you are if you're in Philadelphia, there's many more competitors. I mean, London is very competitive, but outside London, it isn't quite so competitive. So, you know, there's a mixture of ways that people find success. So some of my colleagues, you know, are on the TV a lot. They're on the radio a lot. They get most of their work through PR, really, which is fine. That's a good way of doing it. We tend to concentrate on online marketing. We do a little bit of offline marketing, in our area. So, you know, really within sort of 10, 20 miles of our clinics. But I think we generally find that, you know, the cost is better, really, for our online efforts.
How have you approached that? I know that you're doing quite a few things. You have some things that American physicians would probably find slightly concerning on your websites. And when I say concerning, I mean the fact that U.S. medicine is very kind of litigious. And you have, for example, patient forums that allow patients to go in and ask questions, and you are actually posting answers back online for other patients to read, is something that most U.S. physicians would not feel comfortable doing.
Why, Jeff?
Well, the reason is because that could be construed as medical advice. There is a tremendous sense of what's called CYA medicine in the United States, cover your ass medicine, which is provide anything that could potentially be come back and haunt you in 2 years when somebody has a negative reaction and their lawyer goes online to your site and sees that you recommended something. Now, that's a little bit different, obviously, in your situation. First, why is that so? And then how effective has that been for you?
I think we're much less litigious society. So yeah, in 8 years, you know, I operate on, you know, I would do 400 breast enlargements a year. You know, I do 50 or 60 facelifts a year. You know, in all my time, I've never been sued. Never.
And that probably would be. And one of the other things that you're posting on your site is your complication rate and kind of a report card from a third party. Is that something that all plastic surgeons in the UK have?
Not really. I mean, my view is really that there's a lot of marketing hype, particularly in England. See, what basically happened in England is there weren't enough plastic surgeons, so businessmen came in and dominated the market. So there was a guy called John Ryan 20 years ago who came in. He said he was a marketing guy, and he said the worst people in the world at marketing are British plastic surgeons. And he basically started a company called Transform from nothing. He dominated the cosmetic surgery market in the United Kingdom, sold it for multi-million pounds, bought a well-known football club, and retired a very, very rich man. And has actually since started another company since then. But basically, he put in place pretty simple sort of principles that would be familiar to you guys in America, you know, but they just weren't being done in England. So that's gone on now. So the majority of cosmetic surgery in England is not done by plastic surgeons as you would recognize in America. So they're not board certified plastic surgeons. They're done by big companies who have clinics all over the country and very big marketing budgets. So patients would go to them. So they wouldn't go to a named surgeon. They would go to a company with this name. They would see sometimes a nurse, sometimes not a nurse. And they might see a salesperson initially who would talk them through an operation. They might see a nurse. That person would take a deposit for an operation. It's basically like trying to sell a car. Yeah. And then they would then see the surgeon for a short period of time. And these surgeons do not have to, because of European regulation, they could be from anywhere in Europe. They can be from Italy, where the standards, you know, are arguably you know, not quite as tough as in America and England. So do you see what I mean? So it's much more of a factory sort of, you know, Henry Ford type production line with these companies, where that model has just doesn't happen in America or anywhere else in the world, because you've traditionally had more plastic surgeons.
Well, I think there's that, and probably there's a more of them, and physicians are organized. It sounds as though physicians are probably organized in their specialties to a greater degree, but differently than, you know, how you're organized. It might be that with as few plastic surgeons as you actually have, that the lobbying power, the kind of ability to protect that market, wasn't there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, they didn't need to, you see, because if there were only 200 in the country who had gone through the training, they basically had more work than they could throw a stick at. They had so much work, and they had a good living. They didn't have to market. They had big houses and they were multimillionaires. They didn't need to do anything. And then things have changed now, and now there are many more plastic surgeons being trained, and because they're cutting back on the health system, there aren't really sufficient jobs for them in the health system. So the old way of you went through your plastic surgical training, you got a consultant job, you had a job for life, which was well paid, and you could have a private income. That was fine, you know, 10 years ago. Nowadays, you know, there's 75 junior plastic surgeons coming out of training this year in the UK who aren't going to get jobs. So what are they going to do? They're either going to set up privately, like people do in America, which has never happened here, or they're going to go abroad. So I think it is changing. You know, you're becoming more like us, and we're becoming more like you, Jeff.
Well, let me ask you, let me ask you this. Is the what you refer to as kind of the factory approach is happening in the United States to some extent. There are chains opening up. And really, my feeling is that that's been driven by the development of technology that allow physicians or the delivery of medical services to move away from very high skilled individuals, meaning a physician like yourself who has, you know, 12 years of plastic surgery training and is now in kind of the realm of a technology solution where you have a esthetician firing a laser or running an IPL or some other kinds of things. And that is a scalable model. So in the United States, there are a tremendous number of physicians who are looking to add Botox to their practice, who are buying an IPL and doing laser hair removal, who are kind of moving into cosmetic medicine. And what has been, since the 60s, basically a battle between the plastic surgeons and the dermatologists in the United States, now has, in effect, a third player in that, and that is a internal medicine doc or a family practitioner or an OBGYN who is bleeding patients kind of on the lower levels that did not demand the kind of the skill and training of a plastic surgeon. Now, you can argue, I would say, that that might be more effective use of delivery of medical services. And cosmetic medicine, especially in the United States, is where a lot of this kind of motion happens first. Because it's a very kind of large market, and there are businesses that are in this that try and adapt very, very quickly, as opposed to kind of classical, more conservative, traditional medicine. What has happened in the UK around that, the move into kind of technology solutions, and do you see that as a good thing?
Well, I mean, there has been movement, but technology will only get you so far. I mean, someone's physically got to stick the liposuction cannula in or do whatever. So in our practice, we have aestheticians and nurses who do some things, but only to a level. So you talk about the three groups, you know, it was the dermatologists and the plastic surgeons. You know, in England, there's also the business people, you know, who set up clinics and employ plastic surgeons and dermatologists, you know, to do their work for them. And that is a pattern that's very prevalent in Europe, in that, you know, a businessman will set up a clinic or whatever. He's very good at marketing, very good at those skills, and then will get doctors in or get whatever medical specialities they need to do the work. So that's another whole
group. So in the UK, a non-physician can employ a physician?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, these big groups. They're owned by businessmen.
Well, yeah. In the United States, that's the case too, in that hospitals or some businesses can employ physicians, but as an individual, that's prevented. I can't, as an individual, I can't just go out and hire a physician to work inside of my clinic.
In the UK, you can. Yeah, absolutely, you can. Yeah, yeah. So I employ. I mean, basically, I own. I own 100% of the company and the surgeons who. So a typical dentist in England. What you'd have a chief dentist who basically owns the building, owns all the equipment, blah blah blah, and you get associates who come in and they will do the work there. So they just come in. They haven't got any of the administrative concerns and marketing or anything like that. They haven't got to worry about the equipment. It's the founder, the principal, who's got the concerns of the equipment, and then typically the associate would get 50% of any income earned. So he'd come in, do the work, go home, 50% to him, 50% for marketing, the staff costs, all that sort of thing.
And so are most of these businesses run by with physicians from different parts of the EU, the European Union?
Some of them are. Now, obviously, if you're a businessman, you've got costs to take into account. So they would go for the cheapest. Well, they would balance up quality versus cost. So obviously they could probably go cheaper, but they're going to get more problems. They don't want problems, but they don't want to go really expensive either. So because of their margins, they, it has to work both ways. So often, some foreign surgeons, because in Italy, there's traditionally been way, way, way more, physicians trained, you see. So in Italy, many doctors can't get jobs as doctors at all. So they're qualified as a doctor, but work in a completely, maybe work in advertising or something. There are more Italian doctors. So if you can, get someone who's technically good, they're willing to work for less money than perhaps an English surgeon would be.
How does that kind of balance out? What is the recourse that a patient has in the UK if something kind of goes wrong? When traditionally it seems that technologies have been developed in the US and treatments.
No, that's not right actually, Jen.
Okay.
A lot of treatments have been, now it's interesting where the latest advances come from. Now, they're not all from the US, and in fact, in the US, in some things, they lag behind the rest of the world. And I'll give you an example. An example is dermal filler treatments, which these are gels which you place under the skin, normally made of hyaluronic acid, which are for treating wrinkles. Now, in the US, these are classified they need to be approved by the FDA?
The FDA, yes.
Yeah, so it's very, very stringent. So only some dermal fillers like Restylane and I think Juvederm now are recognized because of the stringent FDA regulations. Now in Europe, they're not classified as what we call prescription only medicines. So they're completely unregulated, which is probably a bad thing, to be honest, Jeff. But so physicians in Europe have been using these substances for much longer and have got much more experience of them than in America. So I go along to the Cheryl Aston conference sometimes, in New York. And in some things, America is ahead, definitely. But in some things, it's behind. It's always a bit of a surprise sometimes when you get in America, because you sort of expect America to be ahead of everything, and some guy puts up a sort of the latest sort of technique, and you sort of think, well, we've been doing that for 10 years.
Well, and that's you kind of jumped ahead of me. What I was actually saying was technologies are often developed first in the United States, meaning a technology solution or something else. But treatments are usually developed outside of the United States. And really the reason is that you can't do experiments on patients in the U.S. I'll give you an example. I was at a medical conference in Las Vegas, and there was a plastic surgeon from Mexico who was talking about a treatment. And he went through this treatment, and it became apparent that he was, in effect, modifying the treatment and experimenting on patients that would come in for a type of a surgery. And he was doing different things in order to see the results and a bunch of other kinds of things. Now, in the United States, that would open you up to all sorts of problems if there was a problem with the patient. So after he was speaking, there was a group of American physicians asking him, what happens when the outcome is not good? What happens when somebody complains? And he said, well, we call the police. Now you'd have to be an American physician to see how, like, that just could never, it would never happen in the U.S. Well, it might happen in the U.S., but it would be big news kind of a thing, So the liability is such, I would bet that there are less than 5% of American plastic surgeons who have done the number of treatments that you have that have never had any kind of legal issue.
Yeah. It is getting worse here, and I mean, I think maybe we're not anywhere like Mexico. I mean, we're much more like you, but I know the whole consent thing in America. Recording conversations, getting people to really sign things. Luckily, we're not at that stage yet, but we are getting there, unfortunately.
Now, well, what happens with the patients if there's no regulatory body and anybody, in effect, start shooting people with hyaluronic acid and there's going to be negative complications there? What happens?
Well, the companies won't actually provide dermal fillers to anyone who's not regulated. So in our training arm, which is called Cosmetic Courses, we only train doctors, dentists and nurses. You see, so nurses can give Botox and fillers in the United Kingdom under the jurisdiction of under the guidance of a doctor. So we train those sort of people, and then they can then sign up to get the Botox and the dermal fillers and things. But the companies, the dermal filler companies, are really very keen that, for understandable reasons, that non-medically trained people aren't getting their hands on dermal fillers. So they're trying their best, but it's not legally enforceable because, unfortunately, they're not classified as prescription-only medicines. So it's not against the law for them to do it.
Now, why is that? There's got to be some prescription-only medicines. Who's the regulatory body that makes that decision, and why are they just slow? Or are they going to add that as a regulated?
Yeah, I think they should add it, Jeff, but I don't know why they haven't added it. I think it was just the way it was developed, sort of like vitamins and creams aren't prescription-only medicines, are they? So I think it just got missed out. I think when they were being developed, they just weren't put in the right category.
Is there no consumer kind of advocacy group that pushes towards that? My guess is that if there are kind of legal ramifications, those are often both the precursor and the kind of motivator in order to kind of tighten those things up. I mean, that's literally why physicians often operate in the United States the way that they do, is because is not that you couldn't do something. If you're a physician in the United States, there's plenty of stuff that you could do, but your malpractice insurance might not cover it.
Yeah.
And that would leave you personally open to liability if something kind of goes wrong. Does that differ in the UK?
Yeah, I think you're much more cautious in America, in the States. I mean, for good reason. Over here, because there's much less litigation. I mean, I've never known anyone be sued for Botox, for instance, because it's, irreversible, only lasts 3 months. Dermal fillers, as long as you use temporary hyaluronics, you're very unlikely to get sued because, it takes 3 years to get a legal court case through, and by that time it's gone. So, I agree with you. I think any of my contemporaries in America would be very likely to have been sued. And I think being sued is such a horrible experience, because as a physician, all you're really trying to do is do your best. You're trying to help people. And then when people turn around and sort of sue you I can imagine it's quite an unpleasant experience. You perhaps practice more defensively, maybe that litigation changes the way you treat your patients.
When you have a patient come in into your clinic, what kind of paperwork are they filling out? What kind of consent are they kind of giving before they actually have a surgery?
Right. You believe this, Jeff. I am one of the foremost people for consent out of all the surgeons in the UK. So I did do some work in Australia, and I've worked in, been in the States, and so I brought some of those good practice sort of guidelines over. Basically, are you talking about an operation or a dermal filler?
I'm talking about a surgical procedure.
Okay. So they would come in, see me. They fill out a form with their medical history, their general practitioner, and on the form, I have a lot of sort of checklists, which sort of say, you know, information leaflet. Have I given them the information leaflet? Have they watched our video? I'm developing DVDs to give them. Have, you know, so I'm doing that. That's a very good tip. I would suggest that, you know, this is given to me by a guy called Daniel Fleming, who's a very well-known surgeon in Australia. He developed his own DVD on breast enlargement, which he gives to the patient, you know, and ask them to watch with their families at home. And he's pretty graphic. I mean, in it, he also says, you know, if you're not prepared for the risk of dying, this procedure is not for you. And then he gets them to sign, you know, that they have watched the video. Uh-huh. So he doesn't need to, you know, I mean, if you're talking to people, five people who think about breast augmentation a day, you know, you get a bit bored of saying the same thing again and again. So what he's done is he's got, you know, this video is an hour and a half. It's a really good video. He'll give it to you free if you look up Daniel Fleming on the internet. So I'm developing videos. So they watch those. They sign, they've read them, and they understand the complications. And then I go through, I've got the checklist of all the complications I discussed, you know, DVTs, PEs, all those sort of things. And then when they come into hospital, they sign another detailed consent form. But the private hospitals have a consent form, which 90% of plastic surgeons would only use that. And that has got two small lines, which you can write about maximum six or seven things. So you have to fill those individually. And that is what 90% of the surgeons in the UK use.
For any kind of surgery that they do?
Yeah. So you do a facelift. So typically, and I'm unusual because I do more, but more consenting. But someone's having a facelift. I mean, there's a whole lot of things, as you know, Jeff, can go wrong with a facelift and eyelid surgery. You know, I mean, there's a list as long as your arm. So they may write five things that could go wrong. You know, eye problems, poor scarring, asymmetry, nerve damage. They might write those, and the patient signs it. And for many, many surgeons, that is the only consent they have over here.
And they don't run into problems with that?
They have not run into problems, but I think they are going to run into problems because, you know, I mean, the American Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, I think, has developed consent forms, isn't it?
Sure. Well, I mean, so, every clinic has probably their own consent forms, depending on what they're doing. But consent forms are something that are sought after. What are all the complications that we're going to need to list? I mean, the idea is not to terrify anybody, but it is to make sure that a possible complication that you're going to run into is going to be on that consent form that the patient has signed it.
I think your consent forms are so much better than ours. And what I would like to do is introduce versions of them into the United Kingdom, because I think a lot of these surgeons are asking for a lot of trouble with these, you know, inadequate consents.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll send you my consent forms for that as one, certainly to get those in your hands. So, you have a training, you train other physicians in cosmetic medicine. How do you get started in that, and how does that business run?
I think, Jeff, I'm sort of one of these, when I was younger, you know, I was impulsive and I thought, oh, this is a good idea and I'll just do it. I think I'm still fairly impulsive, but I think as I've got older, I wouldn't do these things like I used to do in the old days. You know, when you're young, everything's going to work. Nothing can fail. And as you get a bit older, you get a bit more jaded. But I just came up with an idea. You know, I was talking to a friend. The reason is when I started as a consultant, I had to go to Harley Street, which is the main street in London and I had to go and learn me and my friend, had to go and learn how to do Botox. And we paid a lot of money for it. It was just the two of us being taught by this guy who'd got a course. And this was the only course that was available in the United Kingdom. So I thought, There must be a...
Now, what year was this?
This would have been about 2002, 2003. So I thought, well, we'll set up a course. So I had a friend of mine set up a course with me, and that sort of went okay. But she, I think I drove her crazy. So she said I was driving her crazy. So then I made a very good move, and I got someone else to help me called Morag Haig, and she's been great, and she's run it ever since. So she does all the sort of admin day-to-day running of it. I do some of the teaching, but to be honest, I don't do dermal fillers anymore, really. My nurses do that. So we have a number of courses. We have a one-day course to introduce people to Botox and dermal fillers, and then if they want, they can come to further training as needs be.
And so these are physicians just in the UK, or are you training physicians?
No. We've had people from all over. Cyprus, Greece, Iraq. I had a guy last course who came up to me and said, he was there with his wife. They're both a very attractive couple. I think they're obviously very wealthy people from Iraq. And he said, can I have your autograph, Mr. Richards? And I said, why do you want that? And he says, in Iraq, you are a YouTube star. So my videos, I think, are being watched in YouTube. And of course, YouTube now is worldwide. You know, we've had, over 1 million views of our videos in the last 8 months.
And how did you decide that you were going to do that? Was that something that somebody had recommended, or you'd seen some success someplace else that you were copying? But you have a number, you're releasing videos. You've got at least 5 podcasts that you're doing. The kind of social media and interactive media. How did that start?
Well, I tell you what happened. The day that changed my life, Jeff, was it sounds crazy, doesn't it? I started listening to a podcast called Internet Marketing Podcast, which is the one Andy White does with Kelvin Newman.
Sure.
If you've seen it, it's got the RSS feed, that orange one, which is highly rated in the podcast section. And that just really opened my eyes, to be honest, into the world out there of internet marketing, which I didn't know anything about. You know, I'm a physician. You know, I mean, basically, Jeff, I'm not very good with money. You know, I'm not a numbers person. I'm not an accountant person. I'm not really driven by that. I like doing surgery, and I like, internet marketing and communicating. That's really what I like doing. So I've got other people that do all the money side of it. And it just sort of struck a chord with me. And then since then, they talk about, since then I've listened to lots of other podcasts. There's a very good one in America called Internet Business Mastery, which you may have heard about. It's really good. So, you know, when I'm in the gym or I'm just in my car, I listen to this stuff I wouldn't in any way classify myself as technical. It's just sort of taken off, really, which has been really good.
So are you producing these to a large extent yourself, or did you just hire somebody in order to get them to start doing them?
No, the other best thing I ever did, Jeff, was I bought a Mac, and I am not technical. So for anyone who's not technical out there, I would advise you to get a Mac, and it just makes everything so much easier. You know, I edit the movies myself normally on iMovie. And I taught myself how to do it. Really, I mean, the beauty is, Jeff, you can pay these big marketing companies lots of money to do things, but they're not doing anything you can't do. Any of your listeners who are physicians are more than averagely intelligent. Okay, so they're in the top, 20, 30% of brain power, right? These things are not difficult. So you can find, if I can find out about them, you can find out about them. And all you need to do, I produce my own videos. It's not very difficult to do. The podcasts, I got a guy who helps me with them, and he's great. You know, so basically I record them and then I send them to Andy, who set up a server for me, with all the podcasts. I shouldn't say that because I don't think he likes setting up servers, but I just transfer the stuff to him. He does all the audio production, all the publicity, and that's it really. With the video, podcasts are good. I think I love podcasts because I like listening to you when I'm on the move, but I don't think podcasts have caught on quite as much as video. You know, people It depends, Jeff, how people like consuming their media. Some people like reading, some people like listening, some people like watching. What would you be, Jeff?
Well, I'm a little bit of all three of those, for sure. One of you're exactly right, it's the consumption. So I think that podcasts are best suited for, in effect, kind of longer conversations. And that's probably how they're consumed, where video is not, often it's very difficult to capture somebody's attention over a 20-minute video as opposed to a 2-minute YouTube video, you know?
Yeah.
So how successful has that been? Obviously, it's made you a star in Iraq.
I'd be interested to listen to know the podcast you listen to, actually, Jeff. Which ones are they specifically?
So there's one called Big Ideas out of the University of Toronto in Canada, and it is lectures, usually by well-known lectures, and they might be on anything from the demise of the dinosaurs, to Picasso's inner thoughts. So very kind of wide-ranging in that regard. There's another one out of the University of Stanford University called, it's their Entrepreneurial Thought Leaders. And it really has to do with technology startups and companies and that kind of thing. And then there's, of course, I listen quite a bit to a podcast that's put out in videos, actually, by TED. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Technology Education and Design Conference, which is held once a year. I'll send you a link to it. And we'll put a link in the show notes to each of these podcasts as well, because very, very kind of interesting. There's another one that I like called Hardcore History, which is put out, and these are sometimes 5 or 6 hour podcasts that go through things like the Punic Wars or somewhat eclectic.
You're as sad as me. I listened to one on the Romans. There's a great one there. And he talks he takes you right through the Roman Empire in about 100 episodes. It's a great thing to listen to. He's an American guy. So basically, I think podcasts are great. However, I think to many people, you say the word podcast and they just think geek. And would that be the same in the States?
It's a little bit, yes. However, it's very effective because people are hearing your voice. There's a sense of, warmth and kind of familiarity with the human voice that you often don't get when somebody is, showing images or has just a text, description of the same thing. My guess is, and I'd be interested to hear what you're going to say here, is that this has been effective for you and that patients remark on this to you when they kind of come in. Is that the case?
Yeah, they come in sometimes, and I sort of say, hello, my name's Adrian Richards, and they look at me in a sort of weird way, and I say, you okay? And they go, I feel I know you. I've watched all your videos. I've listened to all your podcasts. They've basically spent hours with me, really, a virtual me, and I've never known. Do you see what I mean?
So, sure, and so anything that you're, and this is, to be honest, a very effective marketing technique, because when you walk in and now you say something personal to them or about them, they have a, they trust you implicitly at that, from that point. They wouldn't have come in for the consultation.
No.
You've done all of the marketing and the kind of pre-selling and the elevation of your level of trust beforehand, in effect, in a way that scaled. So super effective, I would guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say, look, I used to sort of say, I'm going to explain about putting the implant under the muscle. And they go, I know all that. And I say, well, we're going to talk about different dimensions and profiles of implants. They go, I know all that. And I say, right, well, what do you want to discuss? And they sort of say, well, can I just try them on? And then I'll sign up. So, do you see what I mean? Because they know you. I mean, the podcasts I listen to, I don't know what you feel, Jeff. I mean, I feel I know I've got a good insight into what that person is like.
Sure. And the fact that they're providing value of you to you elevates your feeling of trust in that person and that you like that person.
Yeah. And I think if you like them and trust, and I think the other thing is, Jeff, really just be honest. I mean, these things do go wrong. There are problems. Not everyone is happy. It's not the sort of so for instance, I think there is a bit of pressure on some guys I meet from Europe who run their own clinic. So someone comes in And maybe it's something you're not comfortable doing, or for some reason you don't. Do you see? So, for instance, I don't do noses. I made a decision I don't do noses. So I think if you're a one-man band, you know, it's money, you know, you maybe push, you maybe do things you don't really want to, you don't really think you should be doing. So I try and avoid that. It basically, if I don't think I can do a good job for whatever reason, I think someone else can do it better, I will send them somewhere else.
Now, you're fortunate in that you actually have physicians that are specializing in those kinds of treatments.
I haven't always. I have developed a team now. But sometimes, you know, you've got to look at yourself and just say, this may be, you know, in England, you know, £3,000 or £4,000 down, you know, I'm not going to get, but I just think if I do this, that she's not going to be happy. She's not going to get the greatest result. I just need to say goodbye to that money and just do what's best for the patient.
And so how do you, when patients are not happy, how do you deal with them?
Well, this is difficult. I mean, in England, you know, we're a bit quieter. We don't sort of, you know, we're not really a complaining culture. So if they do complain, they've normally got a good reason to complain. So, I mean, there's some things that are unavoidable, say like developing capsules after breast implants. You know, it's not my fault, actually, really. It's just something that's happened, and, you know, it happens in 6% of people. So within a year, I have an agreement with the hospital that if anyone needs any redo surgery, it's completely free for the patient within a year. So I don't charge him, and the hospital doesn't charge him. And that gets me out of a lot of sticky situations, because 9 out of 10 things that people aren't happy with, I can put right. So someone's had a facelift, it's fine. And then, you know, with facelifts, the swelling goes down, they get a bit sort of excess skin around the neck. If they're not happy, I can redo it. And the only cost is my time. But there's no actual physical cost to me. And
so
no
you're doing all of your surgeries inside of a hospital. Do you do any surgeries in a, you know, an outpatient clinic or a surgical center that is not inside of a hospital?
Now, this is something that's really very, very different in the United Kingdom, is that I know a lot of you guys do office-based surgery with anesthetic technicians with TiVo or sedation, basically, don't you?
Uh-huh.
Regulations, I said they were terrible for dermal fillers, but they're very tough for hospital facilities. So we would not be able to do the sort of procedures you do in your offices in our offices.
Okay.
To do intravenous sedation like you guys do in your offices, we would not be allowed to do that.
And who's the regulatory body that kind of
It's the Healthcare Commission. So anywhere you do operations in has to be a proper operating theater, has to be regulated, and it's toughly regulated. So there was a guy I know, a very well-known plastic surgeon, who set up a big hospital in London, west of London. He had a whole operating, had three theaters, whole operating team, bought all the equipment, cost multi-millions of pounds. The Healthcare Commission people came round, said, sorry, your light switches are wrong. You know, you can't open till we come back and examine it. We're not coming back for 2 months. Right. So he's got the full expenses for 2 months and he can't do any work. And then in 2 months time, they may find something else is wrong. So theatres are very well, highly regulated here. So there is one surgeon I know who's opened his own clinic and he's doing very well. But most surgeons would operate it within an established hospital for most procedures, you know, even, you know, sort of breast enlargement.
You're doing things like IPL and stuff inside of your clinic.
You could do that, but I mean, any procedure. So for instance, you know, some of your listeners will be performing facelifts probably in their offices. If people in the UK wouldn't do that, they would, you know, do it in a proper operating theater. And we are behind you in that way.
So what is the definition of a surgical procedure? Because you're exactly right. There were a tremendous number of Well, there's, you know, kind of old school facelifts that were much more invasive, but there's certainly a number of, probably at least a dozen, new kinds of techniques that are minimally invasive that, you know, that are using suture plication techniques, or, you know, you're making just 1-inch incisions or those types of things. Would you have to perform those in a hospital as well?
I think some of them, I mean, some of those Hollywood facelift techniques, maybe not. Now, the question is, do they work? I think that is very debatable. Just because an operation is a big operation doesn't mean it gives you a better result. But I think some of these mini operations are giving you mini results. So, I mean, that's a whole other area we could talk about. But, so I have a clinic. So I'm sitting in my clinic now. We've got 4 consultation rooms. We've got, nurses and aestheticians that work here. And we've got our backup office, and we've got our training office as well. So the training people use the same rooms for training. The only things that I would really do in these rooms are like curette a small mole. I wouldn't do anything that requires stitching. Fortunately, a colleague of mine has got a clinic down the road, which is set up for sort of operations. Now, he would do blepharoplasties there. I wouldn't. I do a lot of inverted nipple corrections. I sort of specialize in those. I've got a really good technique for that, which we could discuss anytime. But I do a lot of those. I do some permalips. Those sort of procedures I would do in that facility. But anything bigger, from a breast enlargement upwards, breast enlargement and eyelids upwards, I would do in a proper hospital.
Okay. Well, Adrian, we've gone almost an hour, and I told you we were only going to go half an hour. I very much appreciate your time. This has been fascinating. And, you know, I would hope that you'd entertain the thought of potentially doing this again. I would actually like to kind of get into specific treatments, you know, the nipple inversion technique that you have, kind of discuss some, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I think I could probably mine you for if that's not too pejorative of a word.
But Jeff, I think we've only just touched the surface. In fact, It's really interesting for me to, I mean, what I've learned since I started podcasting, I've learned more from just talking to people. You know, I mean, like just talking to you today, I've learned, you know, how things are in the States and how they're different. So I think it's just taking part in them is, because it's very easy to get stale in your, you know, you do the same thing day in, day out. And just talking to other people, you know, you go to conferences, you talk to other people, but podcasting as well, you know, particularly talking to someone like you, Jeff, you know, you get a different insight into how things work in different countries.
Well, that's it for the show. Thank you very, very much for listening, and hope you enjoyed it. Now, we'd like to hear from you, of course, so if you've got any questions or comments, please send them along to our email, which is podcast@medicalsparmd.com, or leave a comment in the Physicians Forum on the website, which is medicalsparmd.com. Now, if you're a subscriber, that's great. If you haven't subscribed yet and you'd like new episodes automatically downloaded, then you can find us in iTunes. Just search for Medical Spa MD, or go along to the medicalsparmd.com website and click on podcast, and there's ways to subscribe there as well. Now, as always, please consider everything we say to be complete conjecture and random speculation, not medical or legal advice. Laws and regulations vary everywhere, so consult a medical or legal professional in your country before taking any action. Well, it's goodbye from Andy White
and Jeff Barson,
wishing you all the best until we see you next time on Medical Spa MD.